Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of the program, we'll be talking a bit about the habitat in Illinois and about biodiversity in the area. And we have two guests from the Illinois Natural History Survey, Michael Jeffords and Chris Phillips. They are professional scientists, and they know a lot about the variety of life in this region, and we'll talk with them about that, and of course take your questions as well. We'll also talk about a very interesting event that is occurring on June 29th and 30th called the Biodiversity Blitz. It is an attempt to count the number of species in a 24-hour period in a given section of land, and we'll talk a bit about that. And also take your questions about biodiversity in Illinois, anything about the variety of plant and animal life. Questions are welcome. 333-9455 is our Champaign Urbana number. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, which is 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign Urbana, 333-WILL. Toll-free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-WILL. I should mention that our guests have particular areas of biological expertise. Chris Phillips is a herpetologist, and that is a scientist who studies reptiles and amphibians. I got that right, Chris?
Correct.
All right. And Michael Jeffords is an entomologist.
Correct, also.
Good. And also a very fine photographer, I should say.
Thank you.
I have a copy of your book, Illinois Wilds, which came out a few years ago. So, well, just to start the conversation, tell us about the Biodiversity Blitz.
Well, it's kind of a long story. The survey has been doing biological surveys for almost 145 years, and we do it as individual scientists and as part of projects and so forth, and we thought, well, it's a new millennium, and perhaps we should kind of showcase what the kind of research that we do and the kind of science that we do, and there's a trend going across the country where a lot of places have been doing what are called bioblitzes. And, you know, Walden Pond did one, Washington and several parks and so forth. There's never been one done in the Midwest. And I got this idea at a conference from the World Wildlife Federation last year. And I said, well, let's see if the survey would be interested in doing a biodiversity blitz, because we have a tremendous resource. We have hundreds of scientists at the Natural History Survey, not all systematists, but a good percentage of them can certainly identify organisms. So we decided, well, where should we do this? And well, the logical place is Robert Allerton Park, because it's big enough to be challenging, small enough to be doable, a diversity of habitats to keep a lot of different biologists interested in doing the project. And so we're trying to break the temperate zone biodiversity blitz record of 1905 species from Walden Pond. So we think we can do it, but I mean, and we know we can collect that many. We just don't know if we can identify them all.
Yeah, right. Okay, so this is 24 hours between, was it 2 p.m. on June 29th?
2 p.m. June 29th to 2 p.m. on June 30th.
And you're going to just try to count as many species.
Count and identify as many species as possible. And we're going to hedge it a little bit, and we're going to accept morpho species, which is a concept basically is you identify it as far down as you can, and then you say, well, this is different from all other species. That's only relevant to the entomologists and the invertebrate people. We expect the vertebrate people and the plant people to be able to identify the species.
And you're looking at plants, animals, insects?
Insects, mites, protozoa, euglena, one-celled animals, all the way up to birds, to mammals, everything.
Wow.
It's an all taxa, meaning all groups.
And how do you go about that?
Organization. we have a great range of expertise at this survey, although we certainly don't cover all of those groups. So we've covered as many as we can internally, and then we have scientists coming in from, there's one from ISU. He's one of the world authorities on the Socoptera, which is the bark lice, and it's probably not a great charismatic group, but nonetheless. We have John Ebinger from Eastern Illinois University coming in. He's probably one of the best field botanists in Illinois. He's retired emeritus, and he's a member of the survey as an affiliate, and he's also on our board. So he's going to organize the botanists. And we have U of I a few U of I scientists, and it should be interesting.
There's got to be obviously a method to this madness. What kind of system? I mean, how do you go about compiling the information? I mean, you know, physically, what's going to happen?
We have all the scientists will have the same data sheet, and they will fill it out. And we'll have bucket drops at Allerton, and there'll be periodic data collection. And we're actually setting up a small network system at Allerton. We'll have four PCs, one acting as a server, two data entry people, and then we'll have it projected on the screen so people can actually see the process of data entry and so forth and identification. And we're using a fairly sophisticated database, which was basically modified just for this BioBlitz. So we've got computer people involved in it, network people, data entry people. So everybody from secretaries up to the scientists are involved in the process.
And you're expecting, I mean, obviously different species would be countable at different times of the day and night.
Right. Obviously the diurnal people go out during the day and do their thing, but we have mist netting going on in the evenings, and we'll have mammal, you know, live trapping of mammals, insect black lighting, pitfall traps, all those sorts of things. And everything that can be identified without being collected and harmed will be. So, but, you know, invertebrates and a few of those will be collected and for identification purposes, but everything else will be capture and release.
You mentioned that a number of scientists are involved in this, but you're also inviting the public to be involved in to some extent.
Yes, we have three ways the public can be involved. We actually have what are called excursions, where you can actually sign up and go with Chris to do his herp sample, or you can go with Joyce Hoffman to do her bat sampling and so forth. And there's a finite number because you can't have too many. And then there's going to be presentations at the Red Barn on Friday evening and Saturday morning and afternoon, and there's several of those. And there's 20-minute presentations, and people can just come and see the biologist, and they'll tell them what they do and why they do it and so forth. And if you're a teacher, we're also offering what are called CPDU credits. So if you go to those, you can get actually recertification credits because this is a learning process. It's not a big circus affair. It's a biological entity that's going on, which can be observed by families and the public.
What do you think people would get from observing the process, or, you know, what kind of things do you hope people would learn?
How biologists work, some of the difficulty involved in identifying an organism. I mean, Chris can pick up a snake and say, this is A, but what you don't realize is there's a huge amount of pre-knowledge and experience built into that identification, and that's kind of the process we want people to see. And the bottom line of all biological knowledge is, what is it? And put a name on it. Otherwise, you're talking in the dark.
Right. It sounds to me like the record held at Walden Pond, 1,905 species. Just based on reading a little bit about the diversity of biological life in Illinois, that breaking that record might be very doable.
We think so.
Yeah.
For instance, Walden only had 505 species of insects.
Yeah.
Well, in Illinois, we have at least 24,000 species that we know about.
Right.
A good percentage of those may be at Allerton. The soil organisms, we have two really good soil invertebrate specialists, and the soil is a limitless sink of things we don't know what they are, but so it shouldn't be a problem. We're expecting the bird people and the vertebrate people to do their share, and the botanists will certainly have a great influence because there's potentially 900 species of plants in Allerton. So we'd like to find at least 90% of those because they're just sitting there.
Let's turn to Chris Phillips and ask a couple questions about herpetology in this area. I think, you know, obviously there's some snakes and frogs and things like that, but maybe there's a lot of life that people aren't aware of in this area, in the amphibian and reptile category.
Well, certainly one of the most overlooked is salamanders. Now, we don't have a lot, but they're one of the amphibians, and there are, you know, 10 or 11 species that could be found, but you have to look. They're secretive, much more secretive than frogs, for example. So salamanders are often overlooked, and turtles are overlooked as well. You see an occasional one on the road, but there's a large number of turtles that never leave the water, and so you won't see them out cruising around on the road. So those are two groups that come to mind, and amphibians and reptiles.
How do you go about, I mean, obviously these are rather bashful creatures. I mean, they don't exactly like to be counted. How do you go about it?
Well, you just use all the tricks in your bag, and brute force is one of the easiest ways. You just put more people out there looking for them. And, you know, you have to look under logs and stones, look in places where they're going to be. A lot of them are small, and most of them don't make any sounds. The frogs are the exception. Mm-hmm. So that's the easiest way, just put more people out there looking for them. And then we can use some hardware. We can use certain kinds of traps that can be set up in a small amount of time and yield quite a good results. They're quite effective. They work when you're out doing something else.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple calls to talk with. Let's include them in our conversation. Let me mention, though, our guests this morning during this hour, Focus 5A, Michael Jeffords and Chris Phillips, both with the Illinois Natural History Survey. Chris Phillips is a herpetologist, a biologist who studies amphibians and reptiles, and Michael Jeffords is an entomologist. And they are both involved in this biodiversity blitz being held on June 29th and 30th at Allison Park. We're talking about that and about biodiversity in Illinois. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go first to a listener in Danville on line number 4. Good morning, you're on Focus 580. Yes, hello? Is there a caller there on 4? I guess not. Okay. Well, that's all right. We'll talk with someone instead on line number 1 in Aurora. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. How timely this is. I had a phone call from a friend in Kentucky last night, and she told me about the Japanese beetles there. And I wondered, do we have Japanese beetles in Illinois, and how far up do they go? I mean, it must be a matter of climate.
Actually, we do have Japanese beetles in Illinois. They're just beginning to show up this year. Originally, they were confined to an area in Iroquois County. There were some interesting things going on in the 50s with DDT and B-52 bombers trying to eradicate the Japanese beetle from Iroquois County. But it is spread throughout east central Illinois, and they really like the things you like in your yard. They like rose bushes and raspberries.
Yeah, that's what she told me. In a matter of a few hours, they took down a neighbor's 12 rose bushes.
Yes, they are very, very prolific, and they have been a problem in Illinois for a very, very long time, and in the U.S. for a very, very long time. And in Illinois, in the last several years, don't ask me how to get rid of them because I'm not that kind of entomologist. And if I was, I'd probably have the Nobel Prize if I knew how to get rid of them.
She told me that she hangs out some kind of trap that attracts them, and once they get in the trap, they can't get out. And she empties the bags. She has 3 bags and empties them every day.
Yeah, there's also some information about that if you put those traps up, you may be attracting more than you're actually causing the demise of to your yard. So.
Yeah, it's a dilemma.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Thanks for the call. Well, obviously that's an introduced species. Where did they come from? Japan, Japanese beetles?
Yeah, they've been here. Were introduced a long time ago, and they've been, like I said, a pest in the eastern U.S. for a very, very long time. We have lots of introduced species in Illinois, which is one of the major problems in Illinois is the introduced species. A third of our flora is introduced. You know, they're not all weeds, of course, but a good percentage of them are.
How much do we know about the species that live in this region? Is there a lot that we don't know?
I'll go out on a limb here and say that we probably know more about the biological resources of our contiguous political area, Illinois, than any other contiguous political area knows about theirs. Okay, so we know a lot about the biodiversity of Illinois because we've had biologists basically studying Illinois for 140 years. Do we know everything? No. Not a day goes by that I don't get a question that I don't know the answer to. No one knows the answer to it. We know a lot about Illinois. The botanists know a lot about, the herpetologists know a lot. We know the distributions of a lot of things, and there's a lot of things that we don't know. So we continue to work. And the larger and more charismatic the group, probably the more we know about it. We know virtually nothing about most of the invertebrates and insects and things. We know something about the butterflies, you know, and those sorts of things. But other things, it's tough.
Because there are so many.
There are so many, and Illinois is a very, very habitat-rich state. We have at least 93 different kinds of habitats. Mm-hmm. Now you have to superimpose on that this huge blanket of development that has covered Illinois, because 99.93% of Illinois has been altered in some way, so which means there aren't very many pristine habitats left, but a lot of the species, you know, have adapted to live in human disturbed landscapes and so forth. So
yeah. Well, we have another caller in Bloomington to talk with. Let's do that, and that's on line number 4. Good morning, you're on Focus 580.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, my question is about poisonous snakes in central Illinois. It's my understanding that water moccasins, for example, don't get above central Illinois or southern Illinois. And, but if you look at the range maps and the field guides for rattlesnakes, it kind of shows them getting into this region. But and people are frequently saying they cite water moccasins. I think they're probably just common brown water snakes, but also rattlesnakes. But are there actually poisonous snakes in this region anymore? You know, some of that documentation from the Natural History Survey goes back to the early 1900s, late 1800s for these sightings. But are there currently rattlesnakes and possibly cottonmouths in this region?
Well, there certainly aren't any cottonmouths. Your statement about their range is correct. They don't get farther north than about the bottom 3 or 4 rows of southern Illinois County. So, and you're also correct on that. Most people are seeing common water snakes. Generally, anytime anybody sees a snake in the water, they just call it a cottonmouth or a moccasin. So that's absolutely correct. There are no water moccasins or cottonmouths in central Illinois. There never have been any, going back, you know, at least for several thousand years. But we have had rattlesnakes, and the rattlesnake that we've had historically would be the prairie rattlesnake or the Massasauga. And it's largely been extirpated from most of central Illinois, with a few exceptions. And Allerton Park, where we will be having the Blitz, is one of the places where we know that it has survived in a very isolated and very small number of Massasaugas probably live there today. So they're definitely at Allerton, the Massasauga rattlesnake. And then there's possibly a few remnant populations in other parts of central Illinois of the Massasauga that may have gone undetected. And I field 50 to 75 phone calls a summer about rattlesnakes in central Illinois, and the ones that I can respond to are almost always fox snakes, which look a lot like them, of course, without the rattle. But people are generally not getting that close to see whether they actually have a rattle or not. So historically, though, the Massasauga was probably very widespread, at least through the prairie area of central Illinois. So their numbers have been reduced drastically because they were reported, for example, in the late 1800s as very common for people traveling across the state. Reports of seeing 20 a day were not that uncommon. So, but today, no, it's a very rare sighting. We try to look for them in Allerton. We have a program where we spend time, you know, almost 100 hours, for example, has been spent over the last couple of years at Allerton. We have not been able to find any Massasaugas there. So even though we know they're there, they're in very reduced numbers, and it's a very, very long shot for someone to see a Massasauga in Allerton, let alone outside of Allerton.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. Speaking about rattlesnakes, you know, I lived in Texas and they had big ones down there. The ones that we're talking about up here are smaller varieties.
The prairie rattlesnake is in a group that are known as the pygmy rattlesnakes, and they're very small. 3 feet long would be a very large Massasauga rattlesnake. Most of them are smaller than that. So they do not use their rattle immediately when disturbed. They'd rather hide. They have a very interesting color pattern that helps them to stay camouflaged. So the idea that they rattle to warn you is true, but only as the last resort. So that's what makes it difficult for us to find them. They're not out there advertising their presence with their rattle. They're hiding and letting us walk, in some cases, probably right over the top of them.
And while they are venomous, they're not as dangerous, perhaps, as some other varieties.
They're not prone to use their venom, just as they're not prone to rattle. And venom is a costly substance to produce, and it's generally used for subduing prey. It's only as a very, very last resort would venom be used in defense. And most Mosasaugas don't get that close to needing it because their concealment, their camouflage is so good. And so they aren't prone to bite, and they are a small snake. They generally don't have a lot of venom then to inject if it did come to delivering a bite. But if it did, the venom is fairly potent. It's on the potent end of the scale. But those other two things prevent it from being a major source of injury.
Okay. Just to sort of focus a little bit on Allerton Park, there are probably most people in the Champaign-Urbana area are familiar with Allerton Park, certainly people in Monticello and central Illinois here. But, you know, we're heard throughout Illinois and a lot of Indiana. Folks may not know about Allerton Park. It's a wonderful place. And maybe I could ask one or both of you to talk about what is so special about Allerton Park, why this would be a great location for doing research on numbers of species in this area.
Anybody that's ever flown over central Illinois can answer that question very easily, because Allerton is an island of natural vegetation and evolving or succeeding natural vegetation in the Sea of Agriculture. So, and it is connected on both ends by riparian corridors along the Sangamon. So it is a repository of many of the species that exist in central Illinois, because there's really no place else for them to exist. For instance, there are 1,453 species of plants in the Sangamon River Valley. About almost 900 of them exist within the confines of Allerton Park. So for that reason alone, it's an interesting place. Entomologically, there are lots and lots of, there's probably 40 species of butterflies in there, and there's only 90-some in the state, so maybe almost half of the butterfly species in Illinois can be found in Allerton Park. I don't know about the similar things with the herps, but it's just a cool place to do it, and it's, as I said, totally surrounded with development, agriculture development, with the exception of those corridors. And you know, that's why it's representative of the Grand Prairie region, more or less. Without there's not a great representation of prairie there, but other habitats, woodland, wetland things, it has a fairly decent representation of the habitats that once existed in central Illinois.
There is a section of tall grass prairie at Allerton.
Yeah, it's a recreation.
Yeah,
right.
Not original prairie.
It's not an original prairie. So, you know, it is a grassland and has prairie species in it, and it has prairie insects in it. So, given that, yes, it's a quote unquote prairie.
It's still rather impressive. I mean, to I was out there last summer, and I was just amazed by the tallness of the prairie grass growing there, and just how, you know, it's an amazing thing to see if you've never seen it before.
Yeah, well, the most intimidating aspect of all colonization of Illinois by Europeans was the fact that it was colonized by European peoples who were forest-dwelling peoples. And when they crossed the Wabash River and started coming into what was to be Illinois, no trees anymore. It was grass. And, you know, they automatically assumed that it was, because it couldn't grow trees, it was really bad soil, you know. And they actually, the colonization is interesting, they actually crept out under the prairie along the water courses, and they would rather cut down the trees, dig up the roots, and farm that rather than venture out on the prairie initially. And then about 1839, when the self-scouring moldboard plow was developed, and it soon became evident that the richest soil on earth was under this prairie ecosystem, it disappeared very quickly. But a grass landscape where you can't see where you're going, where the grass is over your head, is a very intimidating landscape. We take third grade kids to prairies in Illinois, to one of our 2-acre prairies, and it's an experience they've never had before, because you can be 5 feet away from someone and you can't see them. So, you know, the old adage is, if you were a man on a horseback, couldn't see over some of the prairie grasses. So that's extreme conditions in a mesic to wet prairie, but it's by and large true.
Yeah. We have another caller to talk with, and we're a little past our midpoint. Let me just reintroduce our guests. We're talking with Chris Phillips, herpetologist, and Michael Jeffords, entomologist, and they're both professional scientists with the Illinois Natural History Survey. We're talking about biodiversity in Illinois. Any questions you have about the variety of plant and animal life, we'll try to give you some answers. And also, we're talking about the biodiversity blitz occurring at Allegan Park on June 29th and 30th. And people are also invited to participate and learn from that. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around Illinois and Indiana, 800-222-9455. We have a listener in Aurora on line number 4. Good morning.
Yes, hi. Good morning again.
Oh, hello.
I'm a bird watcher, and I always ask about the barn owl. Do you have any census on it, recent census, and is there any attempt being made to bring it back to its original, or is that impossible?
Well, I'm an entomologist, and Chris is a herpetologist, so with my apologies to the birders of the world, I know of a few places in Illinois where the barn owl can still be found. There's a small population down in the Cache River State Natural Area. There's a barn down there that has barn owls in it.
Mm-hmm.
Down in around Salem, there's a small population of barn owls down in that area. Beyond that, I would be hesitant to say of the status of the organism. That's just not in my I'm not a birder, so it's not really my expertise. I don't know if Chris has any.
No, I do know the barn at the Cache, and I have seen that. And that structure was retained just for the owls, but I can't say beyond that.
Okay, I guess I'll have to write to Vern and Clean. Thank
you. You can write to us. There are other people at the survey that know besides us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. You know, focusing in on Allerton, it's a place that, again, for folks who don't know of it, was constructed by a Mr. Robert Allerton back in, was it before the turn of the century? I don't know exactly the time frame.
Yeah, I think it was in the late 19th, early 20th century. I'm not an Allerton historian, but
right.
Yeah, it was by Robert Allerton Sr. And he was made his fortune in the Chicago stockyards,
right.
Literally, and established this pretty remarkable landscape in central Illinois. And he was basically a sustainable agricultural farmer, and a lot of the sustainable practices that are being researched now actually were being practiced by Allerton a long time ago. And the son, Robert Allerton, created the park basically in its current permutations, mm-hmm. with the sculpture gardens, you know, and it's a remarkable feat of landscape architecture with its mansions and so forth. But the land around it was largely, much of it was agricultural, and it's grown back into the present Allerton, the forested Allerton Park. That's a fairly recent phenomenon. So there's lots of early successional, mid-successional forests landscape in Allerton that if you look at aerial photos from the 20s and 30s weren't there.
The question I have is, did Mr. Allerton bring in exotic flora and fauna or essentially work with the materials that he had there? I mean, obviously he brought in a lot of, you know, sculptures and art. Did he also bring
in? He brought in a lot of plants too. I mean, the alleys are, you know, the spruces, the blue spruces and those sorts of things. He brought in periwinkle, their ancestral famous periwinkle beds. He brought in a lot of exotic plants.
Yeah.
For the animals, that's the $64,000 question.
Well, of course, there's a rumor that he brought the rattlesnakes with him to keep people out. There's no truth to that whatsoever. the Mississauga is a prairie animal and undoubtedly was there before he got there. And it's there now because of his practices, and that's why it's there and not in the surrounding landscape.
We have another call to talk with. Let's do that. This is a listener in Savoy on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. I just started listening, and I don't know if you can help me answer this question, but we have a family of ground squirrels that just moved into our backyard, and I was wondering about what their habitat is, what their feeding habits are, and if there's anything we can do to help them have a good environment and yet keep our lawn, fairly nice. I don't know if this is any of your areas of specialty or not.
Maybe not really, but I'll talk to what goes on at the survey. We have a place called the South Annex, which is a lot of lawns in it, and we have populations of 13 lion ground squirrels there. And ancestors there were called picket pegs because they like to stand up and see over the vegetation. So they really like short grass. And they graze and so forth, and we've coexisted with them at the Natural History Survey and Art with our big lawns for as long as I can remember. So,
okay.
If you want more information on that, I would recommend you call the survey and ask for Dr. Joyce Hoffman. That's her area of expertise.
Okay, so they don't need particularly long grass.
No, they like short grass. They've actually increased because they like this. They like to see what's around them.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you very much.
Sure. Thanks very much for the call. Returning to the topic of introduced versus indigenous species, I'm curious what you can say about the balance in Illinois. Obviously, development has affected the landscape, dramatically, as you've mentioned, agriculture in particular, and the woodland areas are no longer near the size that they once were. But I mean, how have the species, how's the species balance, sort of changed with the landscape? Is it mostly because of changes in the landscape, or is it also due, perhaps, in significant part to introduced species?
Okay. Well, for instance, most of our agricultural weeds are introduced species. Most of our species and natural systems are introduced species, and they were brought in for a variety of reasons. Some intentionally because they thought, early settlers thought, well, this would be a better alternative because it was familiar. They brought it with them from Europe. Things like garlic mustard were brought in as pot herbs. Purple loosestrife was brought in because the beekeepers really liked it. I mean, those are some of our major indigenous weeds. And I mean, basically, a human landscape is a disturbed landscape, and a disturbed landscape is an early successional landscape. And a lot of the organisms that come in and turn weedy are these early successional species. And we keep, turning the land over and turning land over, and with various disturbances, so we actually promote their activities. As I said, there's, I think, at least 800 species of introduced plants in Illinois. Some of those, things like marigolds and so forth aren't problems, but many of the teasel was brought in for the flax industry, which is now becoming a major problem along roadsides and so forth, and in prairie restoration. So just a litany of species. For instance, now we have feral hogs roaming around southern Illinois, digging up the landscape, which is a major problem in the southern U.S. and the Appalachians. Well, now they've made it into Illinois. So there are all sorts of woes caused by organisms being out of place.
Well, we have another caller. Let's include them instead of making them wait too long. This is a listener in Belgium on line number four. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning. Actually, I'd like to direct a question towards your herpetologist there.
Sure.
It seems as though there are not... I have a small place that's along a stream that is in the watershed of the Vermilion, and I watch it very closely and try to encourage as many species to be there as possible. And I've noticed that snakes have really dropped off in population. I've been at this now maybe 10 years, and when I was first there, it had been used as pasture for cattle. Pretty much let it grow up, which one of the most obnoxious weeds been introduced tries to take over, which is multifloral rose. That's ugly, ugly introduced species into the United States. But anyway, I've noticed that the snake population has really seemed to have dropped off in the area. If I don't have many cats or anything like that that would be chasing them down. Is it generally the case around Illinois?
Not really. One of the problems with snakes is they're the most secretive of the amphibians and reptiles, probably. And it may be that you're not seeing as many because of your changes to the landscape give them more places to hide, and it is a better habitat for them. On the other side of that, that goes along with that, then you can't see them as readily.
That's true.
And we would hope that that is the case in most areas. And I explain this to people a lot because I don't want them to think that something they're doing isn't benefiting, you know, snakes or another target species. So 9 times out of 10, it's you're doing a really good job of your habitat, and therefore you can't see them as readily, which means they're not exposed to predators, and it means it's a much better situation for them. Your enjoyment of them drops off a little bit because you can't see them. But I think in a case like that, it's probably because you've made improvements that help them to conceal themselves. So it's probably a very positive thing.
I'd never really looked at it quite that way, but that might very well be the case, because before it had opened more open grassland, and now there's a lot more, young trees starting, brambles and things.
Right, and especially if it was pastured, and if it was pastured heavily, the snakes that were there you'd see very easily, but that did not make it good habitat for them. It just meant you saw them more.
I guess that's true. Yep. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. Back to the Massasauga. Is that considered a water snake?
No. The Massasauga is a rattlesnake, and so it's a viper. It's a pit viper. It's in the same family with timber rattlesnakes and diamondback rattlesnakes, copperheads, and moccasins. That family is venomous. The water snake is in a family of non-venomous snakes, and it's more closely related to things like racers and rat snakes and garter snakes than it is to the vipers. So it's in a completely different group, those two snakes.
Okay. Well, I was out at Lodge Park last year, just up the creek from Allerton Park, and I saw a snake in the pond there at the park that I thought looked really interesting. So I was trying to identify it, and the closest I could come to was the Massasauga. I thought it looked a lot like that.
The common water snake shares a lot of properties with the Massasauga. The color pattern is somewhat similar.
Uh-huh.
I would guess that it was probably a water snake if you saw it actually in the pond.
Yeah.
Massasaugas don't. They aren't as prone to avoid water as some of the other rattlesnakes, but it would be rare to see them actually in the pond.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. I was just out at Allerton Park yesterday, and I was amazed by the number of spiders I saw out there just running across the trail. A lot of them you'd be walking along and just see, a dozen or so just running.
Oh, yeah. Spiders are one of the major predatory invertebrate groups on Earth. I mean, if it wasn't for spiders, we would be overrun with all sorts of things we really probably wouldn't want to be overrun with. Unfortunately, the survey doesn't have an arachnologist. We had one who was our collections manager, but she retired and moved on, and that's kind of one of the voids. So for the BioBlitz, we're bringing in an arachnologist from Millikan University, and then Kathy, who was our collections manager, is actually coming back to help us. But there's absolutely tremendous diversity in spiders. Now, the other thing you have to remember is that if you're an invertebrate person, there are all these stages that, metamorphosis that insects go through. So you can collect an egg and you can collect an adult, and maybe the same species, or there may be 4 or 5 different instars between. So identifying things like spiders and so forth is very difficult. But the good news is abundance of spiders means there's abundance of prey, and which means that the system is hopefully functioning in some way. If you come to a place where there are no spiders, maybe not so good.
The other thing that amazed me is the number of butterflies that we saw.
This is the year of the butterfly.
Yeah.
I was in place over in Western Illinois yesterday, and I've been collecting butterflies for 48 years, and I've been studying butterflies, and I've never seen more butterflies. I have about 13 or 14 different species than I saw yesterday. It was absolutely incredible, and they were everything from what I would consider uncommon to incredibly rare species, and yet they were extremely abundant. So if you wanted to have a year of, this is the year of the butterfly.
Why is that? Any ideas?
Cyclic. Yeah. I mean, butterfly populations are extremely cyclic, so several of them may be coinciding. Butterflies also like snow cover in the winter, and they like winters. They don't like heating, cool. You know, we like where it's warm in January and cool, and it's warm. Insects absolutely hate that because they come out of diapause, or they come out of their estivation, and then they get hit with a cold snap again, and they don't make it through the winter. So given all those factors, it's the year of the butterfly.
Okay, good. We have a couple other callers to talk with. Let's go next to a listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, hi. I have a question about frogs and tadpoles. I believe it's illegal in Illinois to collect frogs or catch frogs. Is that true?
The law classifies all of our frogs as game species in Illinois, and therefore, to be absolutely legal, you should have a fishing license or a combination hunting fishing license to take them, because they're treated as a game species, just like fish. In practice, however, you know, the collecting of a few tadpoles or a bullfrog or a couple frogs for your own enjoyment, while I guess you could say strictly illegal, is not something that you're going to be pursued by the conservation police over. So it's just a quirk of the way the law is written that we classify all frogs as game species, when in fact probably only two species are actually taken in Illinois for game purposes. So I don't worry too much about it, and actually encourage especially children to grow tadpoles up and watch them change over, just like I did when I was growing up.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, we've done that, and there's a creek that runs into Mattis Lake that we visited, gosh, at least 8-10 years now, and I believe they're toads, actually, and not frogs.
Yes, I used to live right there on Peach Street, and I take my kids down there all the time, and in fact, that's one of the most common things in there is the American toad, and the toad tadpoles fill that little branch along the Boulevard Trail in good years, in wet years, and they can often breed twice. The toads might be breeding twice this year.
Well, the last 2-3 years, it's been really sparse, and this year especially. And has there been a general decline in the frog toad population here too?
In Illinois, we're not really seeing any of the global declines that are being reported in frog and toad species. But it's very difficult to answer that because there's not a program right now out there surveying frogs and toads in central Illinois. And so we don't really have the basis to compare this year to any other quantitatively. But people often call me with that sort of qualitative observation that, boy, I just aren't seeing as many of toads or frogs or hearing as many this year as I did last year. And just like the butterflies, they're also very cyclic. And there are other factors that are involved in why they may or may not be locally abundant in various areas. And this may be the case over there in Mattis Lake.
Okay, so one final thing, sorry. What do tadpoles eat? They're scavengers, but what should we put in the tank for tadpoles?
Tadpoles, they scrape algae, okay, or they filter it out of the water column, or they scrape it off of the surfaces of leaves or stems in the natural environment. The easiest way to feed tadpoles in captivity is to give them spinach or lettuce. And if you boil it a little bit, it helps to break it down quicker. Also, one of the reasons why they do well in captivity with little kids is if you just neglect the jar and let algae grow in it, then they're going to have plenty to eat. And especially if you think that they may eat something else, and you throw a big chunk of beef or meat in there for them, you can encourage that bacterial and algal growth that'll help them to live. But if you want to give them something, you can give them, there's a commercial pellet available, but you can just give them spinach or lettuce.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We have just about 3 minutes left, and one more caller we'll include. Line number two in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi, it's interesting. I have another toad question.
Okay.
I would like to reintroduce them to my garden. Years and years ago, they were here, but I haven't seen any for many years, and I can't find a source, a legal source of to get them. Can you help?
Where do you live?
Southwest Champaign. You know, I you know, people have said, well, just go to the parks because it's a good toad year. But you do see all the signs in the parks that say not to remove anything.
Well, there may be a couple areas where the owner or maybe the city or the county would agree to let you remove them, because that's not something that they're going to be very concerned about. So one way to do it is just to get permission. And the other thing just is to try to go to some place as close as possible
mm-hmm.
to your area.
Mm-hmm.
And the easiest thing, the best way to do it would be to find out where around you where the water is that they were breeding in the past, and find out if it's still there. If it's gone, then you can bring adults in, but they won't be able to reproduce.
Yeah, that was my second question.
Yeah, you're going to have to find the pond or the standing water that they used.
Okay.
If you can locate that, then actually the easiest way is to bring in the tadpoles.
Okay.
And put them in your body of water, because then they're more likely to stay put. The adults might wander off because they might be trying to get back to their home.
Okay. Okay. Well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Just over at the Japan House on South Lincoln, and there are a couple of ponds there that just are full of tadpoles. It's amazing how many I saw.
Those were... those colonize naturally,
yeah.
We're pretty sure.
Yeah.
And there are bullfrogs there. There should be toads, although I haven't actually verified that yet. But those are the two things that could have walked in there on their own. It's not as isolated as some spots. There's a little bit of a connection to the south. And so those are the two things that are out there to find it. And those were what we predicted would find it. And in fact, they did.
That's great. Well, we're here just about at the end of our time. I thought perhaps that if you want, we could mention for folks, if they want more information on the Biodiversity Blitz, how should they do that?
Well, we have a website, and that's the best way to do it. And you want me to read these?
Sure.
Okay, I hate these, but I'll read it anyway. It's www.conted.uicu.edu/rapcc/biobliz/. And all the information should be on there.
Okay. And I also found, if you don't mind mentioning one more website, a little bit shorter, the Illinois Natural History website has a link.
And to maybe, it on its homepage.
Yeah, and that's just simply www.inhs.com. UIUC.edu.
Thank you.
INHS, Illinois Natural History Survey, might be easier to remember that way.
And I bet if you put in Blitz and Allerton in the search engine, I bet you'd get it.
That'd be another good way to go. Good. Well, if folks are interested, check that out, the Biodiversity Blitz, June 29th and 30th, and opportunities to participate in that. Our guests have been talking about that. Michael Jeffords and Chris Phillips from the Illinois Natural History Survey. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.